Good morning, everybody. In just a moment, Steve Rossetti is going to be opening us up in a word of prayer. And do I need to move this up a little more? Is that good, Steve? All right. So this is the last class on the Gospel of Mark. And it's been a lot of fun to go through this with you. Some classes we've had time to read all the text, other times we haven't. This morning we're going to read probably most of it. I think we'll have time to do most of it. And so we'll look at Jesus' death, burial, and resurrection this morning. And just for the last time, if you're not sick of it already, the overview chart of the Gospel of Mark. Remember that as we've looked at this, the first eight chapters have been showing you that Jesus is the king. But unlike most kings, he doesn't use his position of authority for himself. He uses it to serve people. And so the chapters 9 through 16 is him going to the cross, which is what we're going to finally see in this text. But Jesus had been talking about this moment as early as chapter 3. Or chapter 2, but he really starts talking about it more towards the end of chapter 8 and then 9 through 16. So here's a quick outline of what we're going to look at. Chapter 15, verses 16 through 32 is going to have the moment of his crucifixion. 33 to 39 is going to be actually his death on the cross. And then the last part of chapter 15 through the beginning of 16 is the burial and the resurrection and the women being the first witnesses. And then that gets followed up by the Great Commission. So that's what we're going to be looking at this morning. Any comments or questions about that before we pray? All right, Steve. All right, quick just trivia question from last week. Do you guys remember how many trials Jesus went through between the Jewish trials and the Roman trials? Six, good. So if you wanted that chart again, I think that should be on the website where we detailed how he went through three Jewish and three Roman trials. Now that Jesus has gone through all the trials, they're ready to get him crucified, which is what we're picking up with this morning. So Mike, are you the reader? Okay, so do you want to read Mark 15, verses 16 through 32?
So the soldiers led him into the palace, that is the governor's residence, and they called together the whole cohort. They put a purple cloak on him, and after braiding a crown of thorns, they put it on him. They began to salute him, "Hail, King of the Jews!" Again and again they struck him on the head with a staff and spit on him. Then they knelt down and paid homage to him. When they had finished mocking him, they stripped him of the purple cloak and put his own clothes back on him. Then they led him away to crucify him. The soldiers forced a passerby to carry his cross, Simon of Cyrene. He was coming in from the country. He was the father of Alexander and Rufus. They brought Jesus to a place called Golgotha, which is translated place of the skull. They offered him wine mixed with myrrh, but he did not take it. Then they crucified him and divided his clothes, throwing dice for them to decide what each would take. It was 9 o'clock in the morning when they crucified him. The inscription of the charge against him read, "The King of the Jews," and they crucified two outlaws with him, one on his right and one on his left. Those who passed by defamed him, shaking their heads and saying, "Aha, you who can destroy the temple and rebuild it in 3 days, save yourself and come down from the cross." In the same way, even the chief priests, together with the experts in the law, were mocking him among themselves. "He saved others, but he cannot save himself. Let the Christ, the King of Israel, come down from the cross now, that we may see and believe." Those who were crucified with him also spoke abusively to him.
All right, so we see in this section that Jesus is going to be mocked and mistreated by the Romans, and he's going to be mocked and mistreated by the Jewish people. So 16 through 20 shows us what the Romans were doing with him. And notice, first of all, that they had given him this kingly attire in a mocking way, purple being the color of royalty, and then the crown of thorns. Now, where do we read about crowns, or about thorns, the first time in the Bible? Genesis chapter 3, after the curses are brought into the world, the earth gets cursed, and now it's going to bear forth fruit, thorns and thistles and stuff like that, and they'll have to work by the sweat of their brow to get the fruit and stuff like that. And it's ironic that Jesus is more or less experiencing the full brunt of those curses right on his head as they make that crown of thorns and they put it on him. They strip him of the clothes, which would, I don't know if you've ever had like a Band-Aid or like a big bandage and the wound hadn't healed yet, and then you pull the bandage off and it reopens everything. Jesus at this point had already been scourged, which means he would have been whipped a bunch of times. His back would have looked like spaghetti with a bunch of blood coming out and stuff like that. And so that's how the Romans are treating him. Now, there's more we could say about that, but is there any comments or questions or things you want to add to what the Romans are doing in 16 through 20? I will point out that when it says that the whole battalion came together, I don't know that we're supposed to imagine 10 people. The whole battalion could be up to 200 people, and they're all spitting on him. So, potentially there's a lot of spit, there's a lot of mocking, there's a lot of yelling at Jesus in this scene. But then that gets us into the Jewish mocking. So in 21 to 32, Jesus is led out, going towards the place of crucifixion. And notice a couple things that happen when he's on his way there, or just the traveling to it. So you got Simon of Cyrene. I don't think that people compelled Simon of Cyrene to help Jesus just because they were compassionate towards him. I think Jesus, after being scourged and mistreated and he's exhausted and everything like that, he's maybe a little slow in getting to that place. I think Simon is coming just to speed things up so they can get the crucifixion over with. By the way, who is mentioned as Simon's children in this text? He has two kids that are named here. Alexander and Rufus. Now, the Gospel of Mark typically does not name people. It doesn't name a lot of people. But when it does, it seems like it's a pretty significant thing. Anybody? So Alexander's not mentioned anywhere else in the Bible, but does anybody know where Rufus is mentioned? Yeah, very good. Good guess. So Romans 16:13 is where Paul's writing to the Romans, and he says, "Greet Rufus." And I don't know how common of a name that was. Maybe it was the same guy, maybe it wasn't. But if it was the same guy, can you imagine after the letter of Romans was read out loud to everybody, and then you knew that Rufus was sitting in the audience, and then you also knew the Gospel of Mark, you could go up to him and go like, "So you really were the guy that like helped him carry the cross." So that's kind of a cool sort of eyewitness sort of mark that we see going on in this Gospel. But when Jesus gets to the place of crucifixion, it's called the place of the skull. Any ideas on why it would be called place of the skull? Yeah, a lot of people lost their skulls here, so there's a lot of dead bodies maybe. What else? Yeah, some people have suggested that the mountain itself sort of like looks like a skull. I've never looked at a hill before and go, "Well, that looks like a skull." Like that's not the first thing that would come to my mind, but I have looked up pictures and it does look eerily similar to that, if that is the right location. Okay, all right, so Florine has been there and that's what she says. So maybe one other thing is that, going back to the promise in Genesis chapter 3, that the head of the serpent was going to be crushed, but he was going to bruise his heel. This is the location, ironically, where the skull of the serpent was crushed. So you have some of those kind of parallels going on as well, maybe. Notice that when Jesus gets to this place, though, he refuses the painkiller, which would be the wine mixed with myrrh. He's going to experience the full force of everything that's about to happen to him. So that's him getting to that location. Anything you guys want to say up to that point? No? Okay. All right, then he actually gets to the cross, and notice what they do with his clothing. What do the Romans do with it? Like, they're dividing up the garments, they're trying to see what they can take from him in his dying moments. It's ironic that throughout the Gospel, his clothes are brought up three other times. In 5:28, there's the woman that had the bleeding, and she wants to touch his garment and be healed. In 6:56, this is one of those summary sections of Jesus' ministry, people were seeking to touch the hem of his garment, or the tassels, and to be healed. In 9:3, that's the transfiguration when his clothes became radiant white. And then at the end of his life here on the cross anyways, people are just trying to take them. I don't think that the soldiers who ended up acquiring his clothes were healed. They weren't getting it out of any kind of sense of faith in Jesus or anything like that. So that's maybe an ironic thing that's happening throughout the book. Jesus is crucified between two robbers. What do you guys think is interesting or ironic about the fact that he's crucified between two robbers? What kind of people did he spend time with in his ministry? Yeah, the sick, the people that were spiritually in need, and in his crucifixion, he's with people like that. I did preach a sermon on this not too long ago, but I'll say this again, that Jesus is crucified between two robbers, but he compares himself to a robber earlier in the gospel in Mark 3:27. Remember when he talks about going into the strong man's house and binding the strong man so then he can repossess what belongs to him? So there's a sense in which Jesus is a righteous robber taking back from Satan what always belonged to him. So you've got an unrighteous robber, a righteous robber, and then an unrighteous robber that he's flanked by. But he's counted among people like that because that's how people would view him. Now, while he's up there, he gets three waves of mocking from the passerbys, from the Jewish leaders, and then also from the people on the cross themselves. And First Peter is going to bring up how Jesus handles this mocking, and he's going to say that he didn't threaten in return, he didn't fight back with his words at all. When people make fun of you, or when people slight you, or they say something that's disrespectful to you, what's the biblical pattern on how we're supposed to handle that? We turn the other cheek. Do you see, I've heard one preacher say before that if Jesus would have just sneezed, he could have killed everybody. Like, he could have done whatever he wanted to take care of the whole situation. And instead, he's not fighting back. And the kind of mocking that they're telling him to do is come down from the cross. Isn't that ironically some of the same sorts of things people say to us today? Like, stop bearing your cross. Don't do that anymore. And they're telling Jesus to get off the cross, and then they'll believe. And obviously they're not actually going to. But this is just kind of highlighting some of the ways that Jesus is mistreated on the cross. Anything you want to add to that? Teresa? Right. Yeah, either whatever mocking they're doing, it has probably connections to the things he had done in his ministry. But the thing that's consistently said about him is, you're the king, you're the king, you're the king. Well, people don't like the idea of a king having objective authority over their life, which is what we're going to get to at the end in the Great Commission, so we'll talk more about that at that point. But I think that's the biggest reason that they're rejecting him here is because he said that he was the king, and I don't want this guy controlling my life. Ryan, were you going to say something? Yeah, that's right. That's a good point. Which is why he could probably despise the shame, like Hebrews chapter 12 talks about. He's already humbled himself. Like, he doesn't have pride in the negative kind of sense at all. And so, however people are going to treat him, it's not going to make him, you know, be vindictive in all those kind of ways. Ronnie? Right. Yeah, maybe. I don't think that the Jewish leadership would have been people that would like to go see crucifixions, but here they're going to it. I think reveling in their success that they have on finally getting Jesus on the cross. But yeah, it does say that they're mocking him to one another, as if they don't even have the courage in the moment, whatever the right word would be for that, to look at Jesus in the face and say the things that they're saying. They're saying it to one another. I don't know if Jesus hears it or not, but yeah. Yeah. Were you saying? Yeah, Roy's bringing up the idea of the sadness that Jesus must have felt that his own creation is treating him this way. You remember back in Genesis chapter 6 when God sends the flood because of sin? Now who's the one that's going through the flood of suffering? Jesus made that connection about, like, he talked about his baptism of suffering. He's the one that's going through it now. There's been books written and sermons preached on the final sayings of Jesus on the cross. Anybody happen to know how many final sayings he had on the cross? It was 7. And one of the final things that he says on the cross is, "Father, forgive them, they know not what they do." That's in the Gospel of Luke. And then when he says, "Forgive them, they know not what they do," the next scene is the forgiveness of the thief on the cross. Almost like his prayer was just answered in the next scene, because the thief on the cross was one of the ones mocking him. And then in Acts chapter 2, you've got some of the Jewish people repenting and all of that sort of thing. But the point being that the way that Jesus handled this mistreatment wasn't that he was just silent and he wasn't just grinning it, but he was actually proactively praying for the forgiveness of these people. I think that's a great example. So that's at least one of the big lessons that other passages in the New Testament give us for this scene, is how to handle being made fun of, how to handle mistreatment, stuff like that. So, all right, let's go to the next section then with his death. Mike, do you want to read verses 33 to 39?
Now when it was noon, darkness came over the whole land until 3 in the afternoon. Around 3 o'clock, Jesus cried out with a loud voice, "Eloi, Eloi, lema sabachthani," which means, my God, why have you forsaken me?" When some of the bystanders heard it, they said, "Listen, he is calling for Elijah." Then someone ran, filled a sponge with sour wine, put it on a stick, and gave it to him to drink, saying, "Leave him alone. Let's see if Elijah will come down to take him down." But Jesus cried out with a loud voice and breathed his last. And the temple curtain was torn in two from top to bottom. Now when the centurion, who stood in front of him, saw how he died, he said, "Truly, this man was the Son of God."
All right. A couple things to note about this scene here. The first one is the darkness. So what time of the day is it? It's noon. And then it becomes dark over the whole land. Now, there's maybe a few reasons why it becomes dark here, but why do you guys think the land becomes dark in this moment? What was that? Separation? Okay, separation of heaven and earth. Okay. Yes. Yeah, and in Amos chapter 8, so this is one of those examples of like, oh, this is kind of a cool passage in the Old Testament where it says at noon it's going to become dark. All right, so... And that's in the context of mourning and something really sad happening. Well, let's think about the context of Amos 8. What was happening in Amos 8 that was going to make people have bitterness and mourning? It was the destruction of Israel. And ironically, when Jesus is dying on the cross, what's going to happen to the curtain? The system of Judaism is being destroyed in this moment. And so, but also the saddest thing to ever happen in human history was this sinless man dying in the way that he was dying here. So it's a moment of bitterness and mourning. Any other ideas on why it becomes dark? Okay. Okay. Good thoughts. Janice and then Mike. Yeah, good. So this is a dark moment, a dark thing that's happening to the light of the world. Good. Mike? Okay, all right. I'll bring up a couple other oh, yeah. Clifford? That's a good point, yeah. Other passages like Romans 13 talks about sin is committed in the darkness, and this is the most sinful thing that happened, and so it's fitting that it would be dark in a moment like that. Larry? Yes. Yes. Okay, good. So in the Exodus, the ninth plague was darkness. How many days was it dark? 3 days. And then you have the death of the firstborn. So Jesus is on the cross, and for how many hours is it dark? 3 hours, and then you have the death of the firstborn. Maybe part of that is hinting at, or is a big echo of the fact that Jesus' death is bringing about a new exodus for us. Maybe, this is maybe not as likely, but Genesis chapter 1, verse 2, everything was dark in the beginning, and then God said, let there be light, and it emphasized a new beginning. But I think the bigger connections is that this is a moment of bitterness and mourning, and then this is also bringing in a new exodus. I think those seem to be the bigger connections to make from that. So that's the first thing, is the darkness. Notice the other thing, though, is that Jesus is going to cry out a couple times on the cross. In verse 34, he's going to cry out, and he's going to start crying out Psalm 22. And he's saying, my God, why have you forsaken me? What do they think he's calling for? Elijah. So you can imagine Eloi. Eloi kind of sounds like the beginning of Elijah. When Elijah was taken up to heaven, and Elisha was given the new role of being the prophet guy, people still wanted to go look for Elijah, and they looked for him up in the mountains for a little while. And then Elisha does the miracle with the bears that were cursing, the kids that were cursing him, and he sends the bears on them, and then does some stuff with some food, kind of confirming that he is now the prophet, and you need to listen to him. And so the Jews from that moment, though, still expected Elijah to come back. And so when Jesus is crying out for this, they're thinking, well, maybe that's what he's calling for, but he's actually quoting Psalm 22. Now, this is a debated issue. But when Jesus says, my God, why have you forsaken me? And he starts quoting Psalm 22, why is he quoting that psalm? Okay, to fulfill the scripture, what else? Let's ask this question. All right, when I say 9/11, what images start coming to your mind? Just say them out loud. Buildings, planes, death. Okay, so that's part of our cultural context. We know that, right? For the Jews, they would have known, if Jesus just says, my God, why have you forsaken me? They would have known the rest of Psalm 22. All right? So, what is the rest of Psalm 22? Is Psalm 22 literally saying that God had forsaken David? Because David is the writer of Psalm 22. Or what is the rest of Psalm 22 going to say? Right. David was being mistreated, his hands were pierced, all of that sort of thing. Abby? Right. He says in the psalm, like, you're not far off, or do not be far off. The psalm ends with victory. And the psalm ends with all the nations coming to know who the Lord is. By the way, who's about to make a confession about Jesus in the scene? A Gentile. And so the psalm begins with David suffering, and it looks bad, it looks terrible, but in the end there's vindication. So when Jesus quotes Psalm 22:1, I don't think he just is thinking about verse 1. I think he's thinking about the whole psalm and how it would mean that it looks like it's a defeat right now and it looks terrible, but in the end this is going to bring about a victory, which is why I think in verse 37, his last thing that he does from the cross, or that he verbalizes from the cross, is this loud cry. If you're dying on the cross, your last breaths are shallow breaths. And then it's done. People on the cross don't give a loud shout and then die. Jesus said in John chapter 10 that nobody takes his life from him, but he's the one who willingly gives it up. He decided the moment that he was going to die. And I think this last cry on the cross was a shout of victory. I don't think this is just a final shallow breath that he just mustered up. This is a victory shout. And so he's shouting Psalm 22, and he's alluding to the beginning of it. He's quoting the beginning of it. And then his last cry, I think, is showing that this is the victory that Psalm 22 is talking about. Any comments or questions about that? Yeah. Right. Right. Yeah, there's debates about this. Did God actually turn his back and separate himself from Jesus while he was on the cross? Because he can't associate with sin and Jesus is taking on the sin of the world. That is a very debated issue that I don't necessarily want to open that up right now. But I will say that you can make good arguments on either side. Because in the Gospel of John, Jesus says a couple times that that my Father will never leave me, because I always seek to do his will. He says something like that a couple times in the Gospel of John. So, like, was God literally forsaking him in this moment, or did it appear that way, and that's why he's quoting the whole context of Psalm 22? That's for another discussion, but that is a debated issue, and that's worth maybe knowing that there are different views on that. Alright, notice then the torn curtain. That should say 38 to 39, not 38 to 38. But the curtain. Alright. What was the curtain that was torn after Jesus breathes his last breath? Yeah, Christy? Yeah, that's right. So this was a really big curtain that separated the most holy place, where the Ark of the Covenant was, where God's presence was, to the holy place, which is where most of the priests would go and, like, you know, do the work that they would do. All right, so it separates those two places. On the curtain was woven cherubim. So cherubim are like the angelic beings that have wings. Most angels in the Bible probably don't have wings, which is why they needed a ladder with Jacob's ladder, you know. But the cherubim were the ones that did have wings. And so, the first time that we read about cherubim, where is it? The Garden of Eden. And so, we know from Exodus 26, verse 31, the cherubim were skillfully woven into the thing. All right, so the first time we read about cherubim is Genesis chapter 3, verse 24. After Adam and Eve are evicted from the garden, and God sets up these cherubim and this flaming sword that goes every which way to guard people from coming back in. So when you read cherubim, in front of a location where God's blessings and God's presence is, it's a way of saying, you need to keep out. So, what would the cherubim have reminded the Jews every time they were in the holy place? Well, we need to back off. Alright, so, now what happens with this curtain, though, is the barrier between man and God has been torn apart, which I think is emphasized with this Gentile making this confession that truly this was the Son of God. Because he sees the way in which Jesus breathed his last, that goes back to him making a victory shout rather than the shallow breaths. He's never seen anybody die like this. And so he knows that there's something unique about Jesus from that. By the way, you know in the book of Hebrews, the go-to-church passage, the passage that says, stir one another up to love and good works, don't neglect the assembly. Do you realize that that passage is in the context of God opening up a new and living way for us? Therefore, Let us stir one another up to good works. Let us encourage one another while the day, as the day draws near, and all of this sort of thing. Because God has opened up this new and amazing way for us to all be in His presence, it means that we need to have a greater sense of community than even the Jews had in the Old Covenant. So that maybe gives you some context to what the writer of Hebrews is actually saying with all of that. Any comments or questions about that? Christy? Yeah, the tearing of clothes is a time of mourning and bitterness and stuff like that, which is fitting in that way. Can you imagine being the Jewish leadership? Maybe you were a priest serving in the temple during that time period, and like you've heard about Jesus and he's out there, and then suddenly this thing just rips. Like, they must have scrambled really quickly to get that thing back together. But it would have been a clear sign to them of what was it that actually just happened. This whole business of the cherubim gets us into some connections with the Garden of Eden being so the tabernacle is like a miniature version of the Garden of Eden. Have you guys studied that before? Have you guys looked at the connections between the Garden of Eden and the tabernacle? Raise your hand if you know some of those things. Raise your hand if you don't know. All right, that's going to be one of my next sermons then. So, all right, I'll just save it for that. That's really cool stuff. I'm just not even going to get into it right now, but I want to. All right, so chapter 15, verse 40 through 16:8. We're not going to read this, but this is Jesus' burial and his resurrection. Let me just point out a couple things about this. This is another sandwich section where you begin with the women who are at the foot of the cross, basically. They're seeing him from a distance, it seems. And then you've got Joseph of Arimathea, who's going to bury Jesus. And then you go back to the women at the end of chapter 15, and then the first 8 verses of chapter 16. And let me just point out a couple things about the women and then Joseph of Arimathea. The women in Jesus' ministry played a really important role. We know in Luke chapter 8 that they financially supported him. And we know that one of those women was married to a household worker of King Herod. So where was that woman getting the money that she was helping Jesus with? Herod. And so here's Jesus' subversive kingdom, and you've got this woman that's married to somebody that's helping Herod and serving for him. So Jesus had financial help from the women. Luke 8 mentions that. Something else to say about women in the first century, they were not allowed as witnesses in the court of law, and rabbis never had women be their disciples. So we see Jesus being countercultural. Have you ever heard people say that the Bible was written in a certain culture and it was supposed to fit the culture of its day? Therefore, there are certain things that the Bible says that have absolutely no relevance for us today because that was their culture. All right, here's, just know that Jesus was always countercultural to his own culture. Like, he was always doing things that would upset people in his own culture. And the Gospels have the women as the first witnesses, and the Gospels have women being allowed to be followers of a rabbi. You don't have that in that culture. So you have Jesus elevating women, and their value is seen in all of that. Anything you guys want to say about the women here? All right, go to Joseph of Arimathea. This guy is one of the people that's mentioned in every gospel, and every gospel sort of tells us something else about the guy. So we know in Mark that he was a respected member of the council. Well, what council would that be? That's Sanhedrin. So that's what Mark tells us about him. We know from the Gospel of Luke that he was a good and righteous man, and he did not agree to the death of Jesus. Now, we don't read about that during the trials, but he was one of the guys that wouldn't have consented to that. So we get that detail there. We know from Matthew that he was wealthy, and then we know from John that he was a secret disciple. So Matthew also tells us that he was a disciple, but John is the one that emphasizes that he was a secret disciple. But here in this scene, he's taking Jesus' body, which would have been a public moment for him. And then he's going to bury Jesus. So here, I think you see his faith becoming open and more public than it ever had been before. And he has to bury Jesus before sundown. He's got 3 hours because Jesus died on the cross at 3. And the day ends at 6. So he's got to get Jesus' body ready and everything. Deuteronomy 21 says that somebody is cursed if they hang on a tree overnight. So he's got to get working and get all of this done, and he gets it done. So, by the way, let me just bring this up as a side point. Some people, have you guys ever heard of the Shroud of Turin? Just don't even bother with it. Like, we don't know if it was the shroud that he was buried in or not. There's so much debate about that. Please don't ever use that as an evidence that Jesus was really he really was buried, but don't use that as an evidence. That's just, there's too many things that an atheist could say about that that would make it unbelievable for them. So just don't even bother with that one. So I don't know if anybody would do that, but please don't do that. All right. Notice then, when you look at both the woman and Joseph, you've got this really respected man in the council, a wealthy man, and you've got these lowly women, and now they're working together towards the same things. I'm not saying that they're working like literally shoulder to shoulder, but they're both investing in the same stuff now. Showing that I think Jesus' kingdom brings about a new kind of community with people that normally wouldn't be investing in the same kinds of things together. So I think that's a cool thing to say about that. All right, anything you guys want to add to that? Ryan? Yes. Right. Right. Yeah, Joseph of Arimathea is looking for the kingdom. I think it says that in verse 43. And Ryan was saying that he had to have believed, I guess, that God was still working in some way, even though that Jesus was dead. It's ironic that the disciples were public followers of Jesus, and then they go into hiding. And then this guy was a private, like, kind of secretive disciple of Jesus, and then he goes public. So you got kind of some reversal going on here. Obviously, they're all going to end up being publicly serving Jesus in different kinds of ways. But yeah, those are some ironic things that are happening here. Ryan? Ronnie? Yeah. Right. Yeah, the courage. I mean, if he's a respected member on the council, this is really going to humble him. But if he's following somebody who was just humbled, he's going to get more courage to do that. How do we get the courage to do something that might cause us to be humiliated? Joseph just saw, or I don't know if he literally saw, but he just knew about his rabbi that was humbled. If you know that about Jesus, it gives you the courage to do the same thing. That's why you always have to meditate. I always have to meditate on what Jesus did for me and all the intricacies of that. And then that's how it gets woven into the way that I live my life. Yeah. That's true too. Right. Yeah, I don't think just anybody could have gone up to Pilate and said, "Hey, can I have the body?" Right. So, all right, let's just. I don't think we have time to read Mark's account of the Great Commission. I am going to be preaching tonight on Mark 16:16 on the passage about baptism. So we're not going to talk about baptism from this passage right now. But let me just ask this question with this. Does this text belong in our Bibles? If you have the New American Standard, it's going to have this passage double bracketed, and it actually says that some manuscripts add this passage, kind of assuming it shouldn't even be there. I don't like how the New American Standard words that for its double bracketing. If you have the ESV, it says some of the earliest manuscripts do not include. I think that's a better way of saying it. But here's the people that say, no, this does not belong in the Bible, is that this section in Mark is missing from only two of the most reliable manuscripts that we have, which is Codex Sinaiticus and Codex Vaticanus. A codex is not a scroll, it's a book. It's an ancient book. And these codices have got like the whole Bible in them, I think. And they at least have Mark in it. And in both of those, they don't have this ending of Mark. But in both of those codexes, there is space left over at the end because they knew that verse 8 was not the end of the Gospel of Mark. But they just don't have this ending that we have in our Bibles right now. The people that say, yes, it does belong in the Bible, is because it is in most other manuscripts. It's in most of them. But it's not in the two that are considered the most reliable. Now, originally, Mark would have been written on what kind of a piece of paper? A scroll. Is it easy to tear off the ending part of a scroll? Yeah, it's not like you're going like somewhere in the middle of something. This is the end of it, so you can imagine it getting torn off. Verse 8, otherwise, is a very strange ending to this book. So I think this belongs in the Scripture. So let's just get to the meaning for just a couple seconds here. The meaning of these last verses in Mark. Seven times throughout this section, you're going to have words like believe or unbelief or belief, stuff like that. I think the overall idea is what belief is supposed to look like in the life of a believer. And so the basis for belief, the reason that we believe, Jesus is going to tell the apostles to go out and do miracles that are going to confirm the message. So they're given the ability to do that. Verse 20 is very strong with that. So you're supposed to believe based on the miracles that we then have recorded for us. But then also, Jesus has the women go tell the apostles that Jesus has risen from the dead. The disciples don't believe it, and Jesus goes, oh, I know, they were women, right? No, he rebukes them and says their evidence should have been enough for you. So we have signs that have been recorded for us, but we ultimately have to rely on eyewitness testimony. And Jesus, in this text, seems to believe that that's enough. So that's where we sit today. Yeah, we just talked about that. Notice then the nature of belief. In verses 19 and 20, the text starts calling Jesus the Lord. And it says that he sits down at the right hand of God. And then they went out everywhere and they preached. All right. If Jesus is objectively the king, how do you know if you have real belief? What's the nature of your belief? If your view of belief is, well, I believe personally that Jesus rose from the dead, but I don't think that that's necessarily true for you. Or if you say that I know that I'm going to have to stand before God on Judgment Day, but I don't necessarily know that you have to. This is very modern, right? This is kind of how our culture views things. Jesus is objectively the king. It's true for me, and it's true for you, and it's true for every atheist. He is the king. Which means that everybody, whether you believe him or not, will have to answer to him. And so the way that you know if you really believe in the gospel is, do you believe not only that it's true for you, but that it's objectively true for everybody? And if you start to hem and haw on that and kind of doubt some of that, you don't believe like the Bible tells us to believe. This, by the way, helps us understand why the Great Commission makes sense. Why go spread everything if it's only true for you? You're supposed to go out and tell everybody because everybody is in danger of the wrath of God. And so therefore, we have to go out and spread the gospel because they will stand before God in Judgment Day. It's not just true for me, it's true for everybody. Any comments or questions on that? Roy? Shoots down Calvinism? Yeah. You mean the fact that they have to go and spread the gospel? Okay, good. What else? I like to say that it's true like gravity is true. If I tried to jump off a big building, it's not just true for me that I would get hurt, it's true for you too, which is why I would tell you not to do it. And so if we go on living however we want to live, it's objectively true that you're about to jump off a mountain. When you die or the Lord returns, there's wrath waiting for you. And if I really believe it, the way that the Bible talks about belief, I will share it with other people. So that's the Gospel of Mark. Like I said, we're going to narrow in on Mark 16:16 tonight, and I'm going to show us a really practical way to share the gospel, at least the aspect of baptism with people when we're trying to teach people. So other than that, we are done with the Gospel of Mark. So thanks, guys. It's been really fun teaching it through with you guys.